The first time I actually heard the word or saw the term graphic novels, it was when I was like 8 or 9 at a comic book store, and there was like a bin that was labeled graphic novels. And I got so nervous, I was like, I'm not supposed to read these. They're graphic.
If only we could take our love of reading to a new level.
Well, I've always wanted to start a book club.
Book club!
Four!
Masochist and other deviants.
Hello and welcome to the Book Club for Masochists, where we read and discuss all the genres and types of literature, regardless of our actual interest in them.
Every month, we read books from a new, randomly picked genre. Then on the podcast, we discuss our reading choices, experiences, opinions, appeal factors, and other related topics as friends and library workers.
This is episode number 192, and it is time for us to discuss non-fiction graphic novels, or at least for Matthew to discuss non-fiction graphic novels.
But I always discuss non-fiction graphic novels. There's no, it's time to.
This is true, I guess.
True. My name is Jam. I'm a librarian in Vancouver, British Columbia, which is located on the traditional, ancestral, and unceded land of the Musqueam, Squamish, Tsleil-Waututh, and Stolo people.
My name is Matthew. I'm a librarian in Fort Collins, Colorado, USA.
My name is Anna. I'm also a librarian in Fort Collins, Colorado, USA, which is on the traditional and ancestral homelands of the Arapaho, Cheyenne, and Ute nations and peoples.
And my name is Megan. I'm an archivist. I live and work on the unceded traditional territory of the Algonquin Anishinaabe. It's also known as the National Capital Region of Canada.
Announcement number one. We have a Discord server. At least ones of you have been asking for this. And so it exists. You can join it. There's channels and stuff. Please post whatever you want to. Discuss this episode, even. You can continue the discussion about graphic novels in our Discord server. There will be a link in the show notes. And yeah. There'll be a link in the show notes.
If the link doesn't work, let us know.
Yes, please.
I feel like that's the situation with Discord sometimes, is the link stops working.
That is true, yeah.
An announcement too is that we have a book list this episode, as we do every episode.
We do. A book list of books in this genre, or in this case, in this format, by BIPOC authors, Black, Indigenous, and People of Color authors. You'll find that in the show notes. I tried to pick some new stuff. I also tried to get a few like classics in there. So check it out in the show notes, a list of nonfiction graphic novels by BIPOC authors.
There's also a second bonus list this month of nonfiction manga by Japanese creators, because there's enough of that to make its own list.
Yeah, this is a format rather than a genre. And so it is a little bit like it's a little bit about trying to talk about a comics fiction, which is just like so many different things, where it is just like, we could spend the next 10 years talking about this and not be done. Like, you know, it's like talking about having a podcast episode about film. Like, what is our background with film?
Yeah, I thought you were going to say something like, this is a little bit like trying to encompass the ocean in your arms or something like that. Like,
a little bit it is.
You know, I actually talked to someone a while ago, and I think I've had this conversation with more than one person who have said they don't like nonfiction comics because they don't think they're nonfiction.
Hmm.
Because to them, the act of drawing something is not real life. And my response to this is like, a prose memoir is also not reflecting real life, but they apparently don't have an issue with that for whatever reason.
Yeah, bad news about language and how it functions. It is representational in the same way that a drawing is. I, for a while, kept a comics diary rather than a prose diary, and I think it was probably much easier to express certain things via comics than trying to write it in prose, and also more fun to revisit. less embarrassing and more cute to go back and see my old comics diary.
Now, in comics, that is one thing that is probably the most popular nonfiction category, is like memoir or biography or diary comics about the creator's own life, whether recent or long time ago or whatever it happens to be. And you have some of the major titles within comics that fall into this category, I think. Things like Fun Home, Persepolis, and Mouse are probably the big three. And I don't know if there's any non-memoir, non-fiction comics that would be put onto the same level as that in terms of, like, popularity or how well-known they are.
Breadth of how well-known.
Yes. I feel like I missed one. I feel there's a fourth that I missed. No?
Ducks now?
Oh, Ducks.
Now?
In Canada.
Ah, true. I was going to suggest Scott McCloud's Understanding Comics.
Yes.
Because that is actually the first nonfiction comic I can recall picking up at the library. Which is just a comic about comics, which is a weird sort of recursive. And now there is so many more types of that type of nonfiction where it's explaining a topic instead of a memoir or a historical piece.
Yeah, well, you have the nonfiction comics going back to, where do you even want to start with this stuff? Because you had, I believe, like war comics that would profile real people that did stuff a long time ago. And then in the comics with an X period later on, you started getting the auto-bio stuff out of that area. And that grew into the entire like alt comic scene that was very heavily based around things like memoir comics from a lot of different creators. One of the more interesting ones to me was Harvey Pekar, who did American Splendor, because he didn't draw them. He just wrote them, which I think was really interesting for someone doing memoir comics is having someone else draw them, though that's more common now, but at the time it was not. But he was also someone that did stuff that I thought was really interesting, and that he did things like reviews. Like, I think he reviewed jazz albums in comic form, which I think is like fascinating thing. And I would love to see more stuff done like that. And less motorcycles driving past our apartment.
It's motorcycle season here, big time.
How about the rest of you? What was the first nonfiction comic you can remember reading?
I don't have with me in the room my signed copy of Fun Home, but I was a huge Alison Bechdel fan before Fun Home came out, which is like kind of a wild thing now because it's like a Tony Award-winning Broadway musical. Like that, Alison Bechdel is like, it feels surreal how well-known Fun Home got. Like that is one of the first books, I think, for most people. Like I remember like people knew what graphic novels were after Fun Home came out. Like graphic, I feel like it brought the term graphic novel in vogue in a way that it wasn't before. I don't know if that's the first one that I read, but that one is like a big one in my history with nonfiction graphic novels. I will say when I got it signed, I also brought all of my old Dykes to Watch Out For. I don't have like the big essentials collection. I have a bunch of random volumes that I've collected at like used bookstores over the year. And I brought them in and, Alison Bechdel's face like lit up. She was like, you have the old ones, you have these old little ones. She was so excited. She was very, very sweet. That's the first I can remember. I took a graphic novels course in undergrad and we read Fun Home for that class as well. We read Mouse. We read Understanding Comics. I think we read Persepolis. Yeah, we did. It was a greatest hits. Also, my professor for that one, I think we also did some fiction, but my professor with that one for that class was kind of like didn't sort of stereotypical like superhero comics are trash and graphic novels are art kind of a graphic novel reader. Hit the popular memoir ones hardest. We also did In the Shadow of No Towers, which is also Art Spiegelman, who did Mouse.
I would guess, though I certainly can't remember for sure, that Mouse was the first nonfiction I read, nonfiction graphic novel I read, because I think that was back in high school when I read that one. And I wasn't much of a comics reader at the time. So that was a different arena for me. And I would say sometime after that, and I don't think it was still also before I was much of a regular reader of comics of any kind, I read Persepolis. So I would guess that those are my first two. I don't know for sure, but I would guess those are my first two. And I've certainly read, like, Understanding Comics. I've actually not read Fun Home yet. It's, you know, on my list. Never got to it for whatever reason. Was always sitting on the list. The next thing to read. Never got there. So I haven't read that one yet. But then I would say the next kind of big sort of memorable would be reading some of the materials from Joe Sacco, I think, would be the next one. And that's memorable to me because of the artwork. The visual style really stood out in my mind and still just stays with me today, some of the imagery and just the way it was done. And also, we went to a
talk.
Yeah, to a talk that was very interesting for Joe Sacco, hearing about the work and the process.
And also about the type of people in Vancouver who would go to a talk by Joe Sacco, because obviously none of them read comics or thought about artwork.
Yeah.
Interesting.
I think there was one question asked about comics or artwork. Everything was about, like, the people, the research process, the writing process. None of it was about, like, drawing anything.
Yeah.
And I think that's something that people that don't read a lot of comics don't really consider. And for Joe Sacco especially, because, like, his style of drawing, like, the very detailed with, like, lots of cross-hatching and stuff makes his stuff very distinct.
Mm-hmm.
And it's probably the reason why these people connected with his work so much, but they didn't think about it in that way.
Or at least didn't have the ability to make a question out of that.
Yeah, yeah. That's fair. Yeah.
I've realized I'm just looking at a big list of nonfiction comics and have realized the actual answer. I saw one by Lucy Nisley and realized my actual answer for what the first nonfiction comics I've read is probably webcomics, probably like, memoir, diary, webcomics.
Yeah. Lucy Nisley's way up there on my list too. One of my favorite was Displacements, a travelogue. I think that's just an amazing look at a younger person coming to terms with and engaging with family members who have reached the age where they are no longer in the same degree of competence and capacity that you remember them as, right? And that your youthful self, your very young self, right, engaged with them in a different level of capacity than they now have, and trying to figure out how to navigate that in a really complicated situation. It was a very good comic or graphic novel.
Well, and that is one of the things, is that there are people that don't like calling these graphic novels because they're nonfiction.
Mm-hmm.
And I dislike the term graphic novel for a multitude of reasons, and all of the attempted replacements that people have come up with as well. Like, when people just call them graphics, I'm like, that's a picture. A graphic is a picture.
I'm not very fond of the graphic medicine.
Or even worse, either. When I've seen, I think I've seen a library where it just said adult graphics. I'm like, that's not what you call this section. Like, adult graphics is not what you call this section. Please don't call it that.
Wait, so I was looking up all the publishers for the books that I'd read to sort of figure out what style of thing they usually publish to sort of figure that out. And one of them called what they publish graphic novels and illustrated narratives, which I hadn't heard before.
See, to me, an illustrated narrative is prose with pictures next to it.
Which I also read, and people lump in with graphic novels. So, like,
he very dislikes that.
Comics. Just call them comics, please.
Yes.
Yeah. Fun story. The first time I actually heard the word or saw the term graphic novels, it was when I was like 8 or 9 at a comic book store, and there was like a bin that was labeled graphic novels. And I got so nervous. I was like, I'm not supposed to read these. They're graphic.
And it was like, it was a term that was created to try to create a degree of respectability for the medium. And I think it's now, and like, it has clearly failed in that because people still don't like using it. And will use basically anything else. I think graphic medicine is the only one that's kind of that has had success. And I think that is in part because it is like an academic field more than anything else.
But I also still hate it. I think it's a ridiculous term. As if medicine isn't plenty graphic, thank you. Having been a medical librarian, or well, at least a health sciences librarian, and there are plenty of times when you pick up, you know, a book off the table that a student left open and you're just trying to close it without looking, or like there's some article that pops up and you're like scrolling through images as fast as you can.
I didn't like reading the journal names when I worked in a health sciences library. Some of them were just like, I'm like, I don't know what that is and I don't want to know what that is, just based, and you have an entire journal about this topic.
The teeth one are the ones that got me. I don't know why. Like, I could do so many other things, but all I worked at a school that had both a dental and orthodontics program, and problematic mouth issues are not images I can look at. They're so awful.
I was trying to hide this from the listeners, but I am trying to eat as we record this, so maybe let's move on.
Oh, sorry.
Matthew, did you say which, if you remember, your first nonfiction?
I've read so many comics in my life that I could not really say, though I will say that up until probably university, the majority of what I read was fiction, though in large part that would have just been what was accessible to me due to when it was. And I was thinking about like some of the earlier nonfiction that I read. And one of them that came to mind was Judd Winnick's Pedro and Me, about his friendship with Pedro, who was an AIDS activist. I can't remember his last name. And I remember it because it had a terrible cover to me. It was like a photo cover. So it did not indicate that it was a comic at all, which kind of indicates like when this came out. Like, they're like, we can't make this a comic. It's clearly it's from a guy who was on The Real World on MTV, and there's a photo in the cover. And then afterwards, because this was the comics industry at the time, he got a job writing Green Lantern for DC Comics. And it's like, oh, we love your AIDS, like your comic about being friends with an AIDS activist. Do you want to write Green Lantern? Which I think is really like bizarre. But I have read a lot of stuff since then, and I have a bunch of them in the house. Like I easily could have picked up like 10 in the house. I don't, maybe even 10 in the house that I have not read, honestly. But it's not my go-to thing to read. Yeah. So a lot of stuff.
I would say proportionally, I read more nonfiction comics than you do proportionally to your amount of comics reading.
Proportionally to the amount of comics I read, and nobody reads any comics. That's not completely fair, but still.
I was at a work presentation and someone was doing, they were showing how many percentage each issue affected this thing that we were looking at, and they had put 0% beside like 10 different issues. So I was like, does that mean they were zero issues or they were just less than 1%? And they were like, oh, no, that's just less than 1%. There are actually those issues within the thing we're examining right now. And I was like, oh, okay.
That would be a great presentation to do, like things we didn't have an issue with during this project. And just be like, gorilla attack? None. No gorilla attacks.
I'm not sure if I feel reassured or not.
It's like when you get food products that are like, now lead free. And you're like, did you have lead before? Should I be worried about that? Should I be worried that you're saying your children's story time had no gorilla attacks this year?
Gluten-free apples.
Yes, exactly. So search strategies, did we have any or did we just like look at our shelves or just browse?
I think I just browsed.
I had a bunch of titles that I already wanted to read. And so I checked a bunch out and then a few I found while I was looking for things for the book list, the BIPOC authors list. And I think that was just subject headings. We had a conversation, I remember, in our group chat about trying to get our local library catalogs to show us the nonfiction comics, because it is slightly challenging. Yeah, different subject headings bring up different things.
It's also interesting because sometimes for the library, depending on how old it is, certain titles will not be in the graphic novel section. Mouse is a title that you will frequently not find in the graphic novel section, but you will find in like the Holocaust memoir section in nonfiction instead.
The first library I worked at in 2012 didn't have a graphic novels section. Like they added one to the teen section, and when I was working there, because I suggested it. But for the adult graphic novels. And we had people who came in and, you know, they wanted to read Fun Home and couldn't find it because we didn't have a graphic novel section.
So I've been in libraries where they shelve their nonfiction graphic in the general nonfiction. But in one of my libraries here, the bande dessinée slash comic slash graphic novel section is divided into series. So the call number has the series title and author-based books in which they are shelved by the author's last name. And the first time I went in looking for one of the author last name ones, I couldn't find it because I didn't realize this is how they had organized their bande dessinée section. So a lot of the nonfiction ones are in this author-based section.
Please do not get me started on cataloging. I have opinions.
Matthew, I have a fun, I don't know if I've ever told you this, but I worked, the first library I worked at in Providence, Rhode Island, was down the street from the Rhode Island School of Design library, the art school, Providence's big art school. And in their library, I heard from somebody who used both. They, all of their comics and graphic novels were arranged by the artist's name rather than the writer's, because they're art students and that's what they were trying to access.
That's great, honestly. I think that's a really cool thing to see, and I would love to see more places thinking more about how people find the comics and what would be most useful to your users in regards to helping them find comics. Because I think that people think of them as the same as any other material in a library, and that is not the case often.
Or they think of them about what is the easiest way to make these materials fit into our system and our processes instead of thinking about how the user actually wants to come up and find and experience these materials.
Please take your graphic novels out of Dewey.
Like, I'm pretty sure the first library I worked at had them. I can't honestly 100% remember. I'm pretty sure they had them in like Dewey in terms of having numbers on them. But they had them pulled out in a separate location. So we had a section that was just that chunk of Dewey just pulled right out of where it should be on the shelves and shoved over in a different area that was labeled with graphic novels and comics. And that was partially because our library director was deeply into comics and the history of comics and was like, would come by and chat with me when we got new deliveries of comics in, because I was the person who received materials. And he would come by just to chat with me about what we got and tell me the history of different artists and stuff like that, because he loved it. And so we had a giant collection for the size of our library and our community, like ridiculously huge. And this is like 2010, maybe 2010, 2011, somewhere around there. Just massive collection.
If only he worked for our local public library system.
Mm-hmm. True. Sorry.
It's okay. Onwards.
Now we talk about what we read, but first we have to determine how many books has everyone read.
I finished two. I will mention one that I was going to read with one of them as a pair and didn't. So two, I think, is my answer. I will talk twice.
I read three. I only really want to talk about one of them. I can talk about the other two, but only one of them is really one that struck me enough that I want to, like, the other two range between I didn't really enjoy to I just don't have much to say.
I don't know. I've read like 30 comics this month, 30 graphic novels this month.
Oh boy.
So like I keep thinking like, oh wait, that one as well. So like 7, 8, 9, I don't know.
Okay, how many do you want to talk about?
I don't even want to talk about any, honestly. I will just talk as other, I will comment as other people talk.
All right. I have five. I will try to group them in some reasonable manner. Might not talk about all of them. I will group my two francophone ones. So I read Moi aussi je voulais l'emporter, which is a direct translation, is Me Too, I Wanted to Take It Away, by Julie Delpore. This has been translated into English under the title of This Woman's Work. So the original publication was 2017 by Pow Pow, which is a Quebec BD publishing house. And the English version is published by Drawn and Quarterly in 2019. They have different covers. So the English one has a woman being attacked by a bear, or attacking a bear, I'm not entirely sure. And the French version, she's just sitting down reading a book.
So
much more peaceful.
Pow Pow does publish stuff in English as well.
Okay.
And also, you reminded me of what the first nonfiction comic published in Canada was, which was, oh my gosh, I can't remember the title. It's the one about the Quebecois stripper, who was a stripper who was writing, who drew a memoir comic that she had distributed on newsstands in Quebec in like the 70s and 80s.
Huh.
Melody, story of her nude dancer.
Rings a bell. Vaguely.
Anyway, some of it's been I think it's all being reprinted. Some of it's been reprinted, at least. But it always is wild to me that, like, that was the first, like, memoir comic published in Canada. Because it was completely disconnected from any comic industry that existed in Canada.
Oh, interesting.
So, I've actually also read this one. Not for this month, but I read the English translation of that. Maybe a couple years ago.
Okay. So, this is the one in which I would call it sort of, like, illustrated memoir rather than comic book, comic strip style. So largely just like either full page images or several images on the page. A lot of like handwritten style text in what I would describe as like pencil crayon in cursive. I was really curious. I looked up what the pages looked like in English to see if it was pretty much the same. I don't know if it's actually hand-drawn, but it really does look hand-drawn. And it is Julie's sort of interrogation of gender and what it means to be a woman and a creative as she travels and experiences her life. She's researching the life of Tove Jansson, the creator of the Moomins. And so she travels to Sweden and stuff like that. It's very sort of intimate. In its style, with the handwritten cursive, it makes it feel kind of like you're reading someone's diary that they've illustrated as well. So it's interesting, Jam, to hear you mention that you've done like drawn diaries as well. So I think actually the reason I picked up this book was I was on the bus and someone across from me was reading it and I'm like, you know, turning your head sideways, trying to figure out what the title is on the spine so you can like sneakily look it up, see if it's in the library. So I'd be interested to hear what you think, Anna.
Yeah, I mean, it's part of an sort of mini collection I kind of accidentally have, which is basically nonfiction comics about women's lives, right? So I have like Kid Gloves from Lucy Nicely about her pregnancy. And the one you just mentioned, and then, like The Mental Load by Emma. Few more. I have like three or four or five of them. I don't remember how many exactly. I have a small collection, but it started just kind of accidentally because I would get a copy of these and it would be one I had actually purchased for whatever reason. I think I got that one used. And then I would just keep them because I kept feeling this like way in which it was nice to have this representation of different ways of experiencing life as a woman and some of the kind of different pressures and worries or, in the case of Lucy Nicely's book, like medical issues and things too, that are very specific to having a body with a womb and things like that. And I think that it's just like a little nice piece to have or once in a while when those are the issues that are just brewing in my brain for whatever reason. I have a little place to go to grab something that gives me a spot of, you know, a sense that there are other people out there thinking about these things and worrying about them and experiencing them and processing all of this stuff, and that I can kind of grab somebody else's way of processing through something to help me in that moment.
Yeah.
The like heavily illustrated prose stuff that I consider this to fall into does go into like, where is the line? Because there are comics that are, I would consider comics more so, but are still really just essays that have illustrations in panels. You know, like you could read the content without the art and get the majority of what you would without it. Or you could turn it into a, like a slideshow, you know, a slide deck with like photographs and maps and stuff. And it would be the same content or similar enough content. And it would not be that different from what is actually published in this way for some nonfiction comics. So it is like an interesting thing. It's like, what is the purpose of comics? You know, like what is the purpose of the art and what is the relation between the art and the text? If there is text, because you do get wordless comics as well. And like, how is the story, how is, because it's not always a story, how is the content being conveyed, which is the most useless sentence, you know, how is the art adding to the story, telling the story? What is it contributing to the comic or the book?
I think the art is expressing a portion of Julie's thought process and experiences. I would feel like it was lacking if I had just read the text. Like, it would be thin in a way.
Yeah, it's not a long or dense or extensive piece. It's relatively short and meditative in a lot of ways, and it's sort of, in that way, I think the art is an essential component of it because it is as much about the experiential aspects of many things, and the art often does a lot of work in pulling out little touches of that experiential piece that aren't necessarily, strictly speaking, on the page in the writing, in the text.
Mm-hmm.
And you can easily have works that are not comics that feature illustrations in the same way, or photographs, or whatever it happens to be. It's just that that sort of work isn't produced for adults as much as it is for children, I feel.
Mm.
When was the last time you were reading a novel and just turned the page and had a picture on it?
Not a novel, but certainly I've some nonfiction books in which they sketch things or have sketches included within it. Has been a thing. But I did want to mention the other French comic that I read. It's much more traditionally comic-y. It's called Song by Haïen, illustrated by Pauline Guiton. And so this is published in 2023 by Ancana, which is a French publisher that mostly does bande dessinées and like games or something like that. And this is the story of a woman who is trying to extract from her mother the story of her time when she was a revolutionary in Vietnam during the Vietnam War, so between 1969 and 1975, and they were working on creating films during that time. And she later becomes a critically acclaimed director. So it's this story about her relationship with her mother, who moved to France and then moved back to Vietnam. So she goes to visit her in Vietnam. And over the period of the time in which she's having these conversations with her mother, who's explaining different aspects, you know, the pandemic also happens, and she decides to spend the like pandemic lockdown experience in Vietnam instead of in France. So that was interesting in a different type of sort of memoir, sort of a biography also as well, with this like family relationship that's being expressed as well as some historical aspects.
It's really kind of fascinating that that was one that had a separate writer and artist to tell that sort of story, which I think is so interesting when you do encounter things like memoirs or stories like that, that have separate writers and artists. Which maybe leads into Anna's.
Oh, I guess.
One of Anna's books.
I mean, I guess that's a good transition because so I read Kimiko Does Cancer, a graphic memoir, which is written by Kimiko Tobimatsu and illustrated by Keith Geniza. So different artist and author. And it is about a relatively young person who experiences cancer. They find a lump in their breast and turns out to be cancer. and they have the experience of being able to have a relatively a removal without having to experience chemotherapy. But because the cancer is a type that is responsive to hormones, they basically have to go into premature menopause. And they're like probably in their early mid-20s, like 24, 25. I'm not sure exactly. But they basically have to start menopause in their 20s, right? And they have – and it's medically induced, so they have to go through this for the rest of their adult life. So – and then on top of that, just – all the like early huge decisions you have to make, right? So they're looking at all these big decisions about like, do I ever want to have kids? Well, they're advising me I better freeze eggs right now because what the treatment is that I'm going to go through. I may not have this option later in life, but they've never like had the chance to consider and think through this part of their life yet. They're not at that state with a partner in their life where they have are having that conversation with them. Like, they're just having to literally in a couple of days make a decision. Are they going to freeze eggs and everything that that involves, right? On top of finding out that they have cancer and getting into that whole medicalization process that happens there. It's just, it's a interesting look at an experience of cancer at a fairly young stage in your life, but from that point on, then continuing on in your life and appearing for all intents and purposes to most people as if you are a fully healthy person, right? And then trying to deal with, do I have a chronic illness? Is that what that means now? I mean, technically, they say I don't, my cancer is, you know, fully in remission, but like, I also have menopause for the rest of my life and all that that ends up meaning, which is pretty complicated. And, you know, more extensive medical care and treatment and testing for the rest of my life because of this. And what does all of that mean? It's just such a complicated situation that is interesting to look at because I think so many of the narratives about cancer are about the truly drastic versions. It's the versions that are killing people, right? It's people talking about their last days or mourning somebody who or dealing with somebody who's dying, or it's about, you know, all the chemotherapy experiences and everything. But what if you didn't have all that experiences, but you still had this life-changing event and all the things that you still have to work through and figure out about what that means in your life going forward. I like the illustrations. For me, one of the things that really popped out is the faces in here. People have really individualized, specific, personal faces and expressions, and I loved that. It's like I felt like I could run into some of these people and just be like, oh, you're that person from this moment in the in that graphic novel. So that was fascinating to me, just how much I noticed how personalized each individual was in here. There's also a lot of emotion expressed through the faces and through the expressions that are drawn in there. So they're very much meant to be expressive. And that was very interesting. It's also quite diverse in a lot of ways in terms of who's represented in here across the experiences, and I think that's helpful too, that it is not presented as another white narrative of cancer, basically, or another white straight narrative of cancer. Even this is a queer person who's experiencing this cancer situation, which makes everything about having breast cancer even more complex, right? So there's all of that too in there. So I thought it's short. It's not long. It is not delving into the full lifelong, you know, issues of this. It's taking a slice of a handful of years in this person's life as they go through this experience and knowing what, you know, that this is going to have long-term implications. And I just thought it was I can see why people recommend this one. It's a good option for covering this issue because I do think it was very interesting and well done.
Yeah, there are like a number of other fairly well-known memoirs about cancer. But I think the ones that do make this one unique are that it's about like a young queer person of color in Canada.
in Canada. That's the other thing. It's a Canadian story.
Who's also involved with like activist communities. Mm-hmm. And so it talks about, you know, their interactions with those afterward. There's even a panel of them at a zine fair, you know? I'm like, great. So I think it does give a different portrayal of these sorts of things than some of the other ones out there.
I could talk about something I read. I had a lot of grand plans this month for what I was going to read because this is a format that I do enjoy. And I also was like, oh, comics, they're so fast. I'm going to read so many. A few things. I had so little capacity this month. I've just been so busy. I had a friend staying with me. It just didn't happen. I'm also still, for regular listeners, you'll know I'm still on the recovering from an injury train where like carrying around heavy books has just not been working for me. So I checked out and started reading The Secret to Superhuman Strength by Alison Bechdel, which is the one Bechdel publication. I haven't read all of Dykes to Watch Out For, but it's the one standalone nonfiction comic book that I have not read. It's so far, it's really good. Of course, the art is good. She's funny and great. And I've read so little of it because it's just too heavy to carry around. And it's dense. And I started reading it and was immediately like, oh, I'm not going to finish this month if I'm not reading this every day, because she just has a lot of words on the page compared to some other artists. But that's all right. I will read it. I'm going to read it someday. One thing that I did read, something else gay. So the things I ended up reading this month are both nonfiction manga, because it's really light and easy to carry around.
Light in terms of weight, not in terms of like emotional content.
In terms of weight, yeah. I mean, yeah. The emotional weight varies, but absolutely easy to carry. So the first one I will discuss is Why I Adopted My Husband, a manga memoir by Yuta Yagi. So this is a story about two gay men living in Japan, where gay marriage is not legal, but who wanted to establish their relationship legally in some way, so that they would have the right to visit each other in the hospital and leave property to each other if one of them were to die. And I did not know that this is, I don't know how common it is, but this is a strategy that some gay couples in Japan use, where one partner becomes the legal father or mother of the other partner. Both of them were also like not out to their families, and so had to discuss the fact that they were going to adopt or be adopted by their roommate with their families. Very interesting. The style is very cute. Like, even though it could be like a heavy topic, everyone's always drawn in this sort of chibi style. So it stays pretty light. It reminded me a little bit of, a graphic novel or, you know, graphic memoir, titled What is Obscenity? The Story of a Good-for-Nothing Artist and Her Pussy, by Roku Denashiko.
Sadly out of print.
Yeah, so good. So, so good. If you have a chance to read it, do so.
Use interlibrary loan, people. That's what you do for out-of-print books.
Yes, yeah, that one's so, so good. This one not quite didn't blow me away in the sort of way that one did. There was some similarities in terms of, like, even though it is a topic that could seem kind of intense, everything's just sort of cute and funny and light. And it's written both as a personal memoir, but also, like, somewhat to educate people and like make connections with people who might be going through similar things. In between chapters of their stories, they have one of my favorite things, just a full illustration of the forms that they filled out, and like step-by-step instructions of like, if you want to adopt your partner, these are the parts that you have to fill out. So potentially very helpful. I enjoyed it. That's Why I Adopted My Husband.
It was really interesting to read that one because it made me realize how little I understand about Japanese family structures and like the like legally and socially in both ways. Because in that one, you learn that like everybody is registered as part of a family in Japan. And that so that like this process is like moving you to a different family. And it's like a thing. And so like not no longer being in your former family, but now being in your new family is like a big deal.
Yeah.
And I know that this sort of thing doesn't just happen for queer couples in Japan. It's also used sometimes. Well, I believe. How much do I really know about anything? I believe it's also used sometimes in businesses so that there's an heir to inherit a business.
Yeah, there are more complications for one member of the couple because the one that's the son in the adoption, because he's the, he is the one who's taking his husband's last name, you know, in a different way. But it's also sweet. It's like they can't get married, but I can take your last name. And also, let's get rings made because why the fuck not? But yeah, the one who is taking a new last name is being like reclassifying what family he is listed with. And so is going to be like buried in a different graveyard when he dies and that kind of thing.
It is interesting to me just how much queer memoir, nonfiction comics from Japan are published in English. Because I feel it's actually much higher percentage-wise than nonfiction comics that are not by queer creators. And I could be misrepresenting that. I could have missed things, and there are others, but it seems like it's there's clearly an audience for this in English, which I think is really interesting to see.
Yeah, I mean, as somebody who came to the queer community through manga and anime, I think there's a reason for that.
What are you saying about Sailor Moon?
Yeah.
Are you taking some time to talk about something that you read, Matthew, or are you just gonna...
No, go ahead, Megan.
He read all of the things that I mentioned, so I think just anything we mention...
He's just providing color commentary on all of our reading.
Matthew, have we named anything that you haven't read yet?
The second thing in French Megan mentioned, I don't believe I've read.
Ooh, we got one.
It's the only way I get away with this. So one of the styles I wanted to talk about was I've read quite a few like historical type biographies in nonfiction graphic comics. So one of the ones I read for this month is called The Five Lives of Hilma af Klint by Philip Daines. It's a 2022 publication by David Zwirner Books, which is a U.S. publisher that publishes art books. And this is a biography of a Swedish artist and pioneer of the abstract painting thing. She lived from 1862 to 1944. Klint was deeply into spiritualism, and that heavily influenced her life in her painting. One of the reasons I like graphic, like art, biographies is because you get it, it's so much more ingrained within the reading experience is their art and their work, as opposed to a prose book in which maybe you get like a couple of glossy pages in the middle where they show you their art. This means that it can be incorporated much more throughout the story. She had a really interesting style, but did not get very much recognition for it while she was alive. And I had no idea, like, honestly, I maybe picked up this book because I thought she was related to that other artist, Klint, but I do not think so.
Gustav Klimt?
Yeah.
That's spelt differently. I haven't read this one either. So that's two.
You're doing so well.
But I will comment on the ability for comics to have illustrations of matter like this to make it a lot more understandable for people to do. And I think like historical works, if the person has done the research to properly represent things like clothing, hairstyles, architecture, all of that can really help place you within a book, whether that's fiction or nonfiction, honestly, if it's historical, more so than prose. Because, you know, I read prose stuff that's set in the 19th century, you know, when we do like whatever Baroque romance or something. And I don't know what anyone looks like because I haven't studied that time period. So I think there's a lot of potential here to add that sort of detail that would not get included in prose writing, but that really helps you understand the larger picture of what was happening and the time period and things like that. Everyone wore hats. So many hats.
Just in case it wasn't immediately obvious, I don't have a background in art history or anything like that. So I come to this as like a novice enjoyer of art stuff.
I'll just very quickly mention the other two that I read. I'm not going to dwell on these two. The first one I mentioned is the one I enjoyed the most from what I read this month. The other two things I read this month were Go to Sleep, I Miss You, Cartoons from the Fog of New Parenthood by Lucy Nisley, and Peter Dunlap-Scholl's Nuking Alaska, Notes of an Atomic Fugitive. So obviously the first one, I have really enjoyed Lucy Nisley's work in the past. This is very different from other ones she has done in that it's basically like one page comic, basically for most of it. Like it's a one page and it's got a little event or funny thing or like visually interesting moment or you know, it's just like the kinds of things you can get out when you're dealing with an infant while you're trying to be a cartoonist, right? So it's different from other materials I read by her. It does not have a story or narrative or thematic thread other than baby and being new mom, right? So I still really enjoy the kind of art that she does and ways that she reflects on things, but there's just not as much there because obvious and understandable reasons that are basically represented on the page in here. But it's also about sort of an experience that I have not and will never have, and it just doesn't catch me quite as much. And then the other one, Nuking Alaska, is looking at some of the history of the atomic age in Alaska and where bombs were stored and plans for doing weird things like let's bomb a harbor into the wilds of Alaska. We'll just create a harbor by nuking it into existence. And just some actual testing of a bomb that occurred in one of the Aleutian Islands. And the challenge here is it's a little bit fragmented. The narrative of telling the things doesn't quite hold as a structure quite as well. It's sort of an interesting little piece. If you didn't know these things, it's kind of interesting to learn about them. But I'm not sure that the whole here of the comic from the way the language and images work together, any of that holds together as a thing quite as well as some do, for me at least, personally.
There's actually a really interesting thing with you talking about these two next to each other, because the Lucy Nisley book is someone who's better known for like large graphic novels that tell one ongoing story. And in this one, she's telling like single panel, basically, often usually single panel anecdotes and things like that, events. Whereas Peter Dunlap-Scholl is a political cartoonist who usually draws one panel comics, but is now drawn a graphic novel.
Yes, that is true. That is a weird little paralleling thing that's going on here. So yeah, I don't know. Neither of them was like a thing where I would say, don't read it, it's terrible. But also neither of them was a thing where I was like, you got to try this. This is great. They might be of interest to you. Sure, go for it. You might have a better, more engaged experience with them than I did, but they exist.
It's definitely not the Lucy Nisley book I would recommend to people if they haven't read her stuff before.
No, I've definitely – there are other things she's done that I've loved and found far more interesting. But this has its place in the world and is important for – you know, there are people for whom this is very important. It recognizes an experience that they are going through. And I think that's important.
Haven't read either of those either.
Ha-ha, we got him.
Ha-ha-ha.
though I stopped reading Lucy Nisley's comics a few years ago. She just started doing things I was entirely uninterested in.
Raising children.
Turns out Matthew's not into having kids.
Weddings. Or children.
Yeah.
I read a comic about someone giving birth this month, and it was like, this is body horror. And I kept flinching. And I'm like, why am I reading this horrible comic? This is awful. Anyway. Great. Lucy Nisley, tremendous artist.
Yes.
Very good at drawing.
I'm excited to see what her kids' comics will be like. Because from following her on Instagram, I will not be surprised. I took a screenshot because I liked it so much. She did a Instagram story just with her kid holding up his pictures that he drew of Homestar Runner and Homsar.
It's great.
Which is a character from Homestar Runner.
I kind of hoped that she would put out a book about the cat.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there's just so many things about that cat. And I'm just like, where's the cat book?
Okay, I have one other manga that I read. It is My Brain is Different, Stories of ADHD and Other Developmental Disorders, 9 True Stories Illustrated by Monzusu. So Monzusu tells her own story and illustrates it, and then got submissions from other folks and illustrates their stories. In theory, I was going to read this in a pair because I checked out two nonfiction comics about ADHD, which longtime listeners may know I am diagnosed with. Yes, so this was one, and Button Pusher by Tyler Page is a recent U.S. middle grade graphic novel that I did not get to because of aforementioned problems and also possibly ADHD.
I was going to ask if there was some degree of irony in not being able to read this one.
Yeah, I was really interested to read this one. I'm still interested to read Button Pusher, but I was really interested to read this one because I am intrigued by what the experience of ADHD is like in Japan and what... how culturally it's viewed or treated differently. I don't know if I learned that necessarily from reading this. I know from traveling or planning travel that, for example, Adderall is not legal in Japan. It's not prescribed. You cannot bring it into Japan. Hot tip for anyone listening who takes ADHD medication, look up what the requirements are to bring it into the country you're traveling to, because it is classified as a narcotic in many places. And you do not want to deal with that, especially if you're traveling to a country where you don't speak the language. I might be speaking from firsthand experience. Who knows? Who could say? It was not Japan, thankfully. They have a very I'm scared of doing anything wrong in Japan. They throw people in jail for not having their driver's license on them while they're walking, kind of thing. Is my impression. I felt like I did not necessarily learn, or it's changed a lot since the last time I looked into it, or I just don't know. I felt like I didn't come away with a good, fulsome understanding of how ADHD is viewed in Japan, how it is diagnosed and treated. I think even just the fact that it is labeled Stories of ADHD and Other Developmental Disorders, that's not how we talk about ADHD in Canada and the United States. Also, a number of people, it listed at the beginning, each person and their diagnosis and comorbidities and if they take medication and what it is. And for a lot of them, they also were listed as having being on the autism spectrum. But very rarely was that discussed in any depth. There was one story where it was a parent telling their child's story, and their child is on the autism spectrum, and that went into more detail. But a number of people have ADHD and are on the autism spectrum, and so just the autism spectrum was not mentioned at all. And so I feel like it, that detail It's interesting that it communicates to me that I don't actually understand what's going on. I am super interested in the ways that ADHD and autism are sometimes grouped together and what those things might have in common. But I also feel like I have never found a text. I found texts that group them together in that way, but none that like go into any depth discussing why they do that. There's also one character who like is listed as also having schizophrenia. And I feel like in the, you know, in North America, that is a huge, they didn't mention it at all. Like it just at the beginning of the chapter, like, and they have schizophrenia and did not come up in the personal narrative. And maybe that's just because that is not what this particular anthology is about. But also, I feel like it did not clarify for me really what mental health care is like in Japan. I think the thing that I really enjoyed about it is that there is a lot that, even though there are like cultural differences, was really like affirming. And this is going to maybe sound odd. There were a number of folks who really struggled with self-hate and in some cases suicidal ideation. And I, you know other folks who have ADHD who have dealt with suicidal ideation, which is not necessarily something that people associate with ADHD. But it felt like the emotional aspects of it that I think just in the last couple of years, people are starting to talk about and think about more. Those were like included and represented here. That was maybe the thing that I liked the most about it, that it was meaningful and affirming, even if it is not necessarily happy to discuss. I was glad that was touched upon and included, that it is something that can not only like affects, you know, school and work, but also is a very like can be a very emotional struggle.
I think that's one of the major challenges I found with reading especially nonfiction Japanese comics is how the lack of context for so many of them. These are comics created for a Japanese audience who know the cultural context that they fit into. And sometimes you get explanatory translation notes in the back of them, and sometimes you don't. And sometimes the notes are great and provide a lot of the context you're missing. And other times you're just left lost as to what, like, how common is this person's experience? How are the reactions to this, like, what everyone in Japan feels like? Or is this a very specific thing? And not knowing that can make reading these things sometimes frustrating. Some of the ones I've read about this thing talk about how the language that is used by Japanese people in regards to things like health and sexuality and stuff are different from the terms that are used in America and in the English-speaking world. Because it's a different culture and these things are considered differently. So
there was a guide to honorifics at the beginning of this, which is someone who reads a lot of manga. I'm okay on those.
So I haven't read Button Pusher, but I looked it up. And the description on the publisher website, I think this is funny, says a memoir-driven realistic graphic novel.
Interesting.
That's just gibberish.
When I first heard about it, thought it was fiction. And then when we got it in the collection, it's under nonfiction. And I was like, oh, I can read it for this month. But yeah, it might be both and neither.
Well, that goes into another topic that I think is interesting to discuss, which are like, where is the line between fiction and nonfiction for some of these things? One of the creators that I would classify as a nonfiction comics creator is Jay Hostler, who did Last of the Sandwalkers, Clan, I never know how to pronounce it, APIS, about bees. And these are like kind of science education comics about insects that are filled with like talking insects that wear hats and have like lives and emotions and stuff, which is like obviously fiction, but you're learning about the lives of bees or the lives of these like beetles and other creatures and stuff like that. Like in my mind, they're nonfiction because I'm like learning stuff. But other people would be like, there's a talking beetle in this comic, Matthew, and this is obviously fiction. And so like the educational one is a really interesting thing to consider in this. And because so many of the stuff we've read were like memoir comics as opposed to other types of nonfiction, I think it's interesting to look at this.
You have so nicely set up a segue for me. So the last book I wanted to talk about was not in this style of like history, biography, or autobiography memoir, and is instead an instructional nonfiction.
Is it about bicycles?
No. It's called The Comic Book Guide to Growing Food. It's by, I'm going to mess up these people's names, so I apologize in advance, Joseph Trykonovich, and illustrated by Liz Anna Kozik. It was published in 2021 by 10 Speed Press, which as far as I could tell has been absorbed by Penguin Random House, but they generally publish illustrated and prescriptive nonfiction. And so this is just like a step-by-step guide to vegetable gardening in raised beds, but it uses the conceit of two characters. There's George, who is an older fellow, and Maya, who is his neighbor, and Maya helps him out with his annoying computer email problems, and he offers to help when she expresses interest in gardening, because he has a luscious, wonderful, well-developed gardening. So he walks her through all of the steps, all of the processes for figuring out where to put your beds so they get enough light, how to build the raised garden beds, what you put in them, how to, you know, pick your plants, not too many because you're a beginner, like, don't get yourself in too deep, how close together you need to plant them, what you do afterwards, all the way up to, like, at the end of the season, have a party, basically. And I am fairly certain these two people are fictional people, as much as the intent of the book is, like you said, Matthew, to explain facts and learning. And it's a type of nonfiction comic that I enjoy occasionally because it's got that visual aspect that really helps out with certain topics, and understanding and being able to see at the same time is really helpful.
There's a lot of like guides to philosophy and history and things like that that are sort of like, yes, maybe this is Aristotle, but Aristotle sure as heck never said anything like what he is wandering around or looked anything like that image being drawn, floating around on the page, doing whatever random thing they're doing in order to explain the concept over the real representation sometimes. Not always, right? But that is certainly a thing that I have seen that is, you know, narrativizing it or, and I'm making up lovely words for this, narrativizing your nonfiction, your facts, in order to give them a frame and presentation that helps get across the whatever the primary, you know, core of the message is that you're or core of the educational component is that you're trying to share there.
And it's something that happens in all like memoir nonfiction as well, like because those are going to be filled with dialogue between characters, comics or prose or whatever. And like maybe some of those lines were said by those people, but the majority of them are just going to be like fitting the scene of what happened while the words might not be, you know, 100% accurate to what actually was said.
I think we're at appeal factors.
I think it's the same for any nonfiction topic. You know, any reason why someone might read nonfiction is the same, could be the same reason that someone reads a nonfiction comic. And then you have people like me that will read things because they're comics, regardless of the content.
But why, if you could say, if you went to relevant sections the bookshelves in the library, why might you pick up the guide to gardening that you read, Megan, in the comic book form versus a...
Some things are just so much easier and faster with illustrations rather than prose. Like, it could take you 15 minutes to figure out what the author meant when they described this certain setup, and then you see the diagram and you're like, oh, okay, I see. I think I've mentioned explicitly, like, both the art in the biography and the instructional ones, that is certainly a full-on appeal for me.
I think one of the appeals for graphic novels specifically is that it's not going to be as long as reading an equivalent book in prose. They generally don't take as long. And in some cases, it's because you're basically reading an essay, not in terms of the amount of text you're reading, versus a full-length, several hundred-page-long book. And like I talked earlier about how like the art can be used to set things like setting and character and time period and stuff in ways that would have to be described in prose, but you can just have like alongside what's going on.
Yeah, for sure.
You can do so much visual communication with the equivalent, you know, like a, well, it's equivalent to like adding good diagrams and like figures and things to like a report. Like they can communicate so much so quickly content wise. That can add a lot of additional information to something without necessarily adding a huge amount of additional time to the experience.
They can also really help to make the story seem more real in some ways. If you look at Joe Sacco's work, because of his art style, which is very realistic and like photo referenced, the people in his comics, you feel you would recognize them if you saw them in the street because they're so... It can make the story feel more real and the people involved with it more real than just reading about it in prose for some folks.
I feel like the inverse can also be true for comics art that is less detailed. I'm thinking of Persepolis and how in that one, like the drawing style is much more simple, but it's much easier to like, in that case, it's easy to like project yourself onto the people on the page.
Definitely.
And also, since that one is a child's perspective, I think like these like childlike drawings of like rows of dead bodies is always an image I remember from Persepolis. I feel like that hits so hard, much harder home, rather than like, you know, in prose trying to describe what it felt like as a child to see these things happening around you.
I was also thinking when you mentioned Joe Sacco, Matthew, about, you know, sometimes it isn't shorter or faster because there's actually so much visual information to take in. And you spend a lot of time sitting with that in addition to the text information. Also because some of his have literal essays combined with the actual like comic and these very, I can't imagine the amount of time it takes to draw those comics.
But yeah, it does very much depend on the art style.
Yeah.
And also the reader, for that matter. Some people might just breeze through that stuff and not spend as much time looking at it. And other people will spend a lot more time looking at the art. So,
because there is a whole visual language that you kind of learn and develop in terms of reading comics. And so, you know, the more that you have read, the more capacity you might have to quickly read through them. Or the more you may be caught to pause on something that another person might not have noticed or picked up on in there, given different visual cues in it. But that's often a thing I think about, for some people, reading the text version is more approachable, and for some people, reading the comics version is more approachable. And that's not a judgment on either side of that equation. It's literally just the different ways that we find taking in information to work for us and different types of communication. And I think that's awesome. And we should take advantage of that more and support and produce and encourage people to read more of these kinds of materials, because I think they're pretty amazing quite frequently.
Yeah, I think the art and the art style and the way that it's incorporated allows the creators to tell different types of stories sometimes in very effective ways. I remember reading, there's a Quebec artist called Sivian who wrote a BD called Ping Pong, where it's basically her struggling with trying to improve her art as a very intense kind of person. And then the what she does on the page in support of what her work is like was really fascinating.
There was one a graphic novel I read, I think pretty much at my desk at work. I just got pulled into it and just sat and read the whole thing, which was Dumb Living Without a Voice by Georgia Weber, that I read within the last year. And I remember looking at reviews and some people being like, this book kind of got turned into gibberish towards the end. And I got so mad because it is a story about a person who, in addition to being a comics artist, is a vocalist and loses her voice and like is on vocal rest and like literally cannot talk without hurting herself. And how, yeah, just how, to me, it was very obvious that she was doing something with the art. She, like, people complain, like, she stopped using words. It's like, yeah, you think maybe there's a reason? Like, she's doing something with the art that, like, she, like, absolutely couldn't represent through prose because she had this experience of losing language. Like, yeah, I don't know. It was very good, but just, yeah, thought of it talking about, like, things you can achieve through different art styles. And certainly, like, most of the graphic novel or, you know, graphic nonfiction, we should have picked a term before we started, but
comics.
We understand. Yes, is like very sort of standard comic panels, word balloons, you know, inner monologue in prose that like deteriorates as like her experience of being understood deteriorates. And being able to do both things through the art, and you know, just one artist in one book using different art styles to communicate different things.
I don't know why, but it that reminded me of a book about, I believe it was their partner or something dying from throat cancer.
Oh dear.
It's called When David Lost His Voice by Judith Vanistendahl. It was devastating. I remember sitting on my parents' couch in the living room, bawling my eyes out. Like, but it's very distinctive, and its art was very distinctive, and that was a huge portion of what hit home. I was, like, devastated after I read it. I was like, well, I'm never reading that again. But it was extremely effective, right? It's, like, using the art in a way to just express the devastation of that experience. It was devastating in the kind of way where you're like, boy, that was good.
I feel like when we were talking about like the big ones, the Mouse and Fun Home, and Blankets was another one that I thought of was like one of those. I think it is less so now, but certainly like 10 years ago.
Yeah, the author of that has done some stuff that has made him less popular.
That's, yeah, I couldn't remember the details, but I did have the impression that that one did not, yes, that his career did not age well. If any listeners are interested in comics about losing your voice, we've got a lot of recommendations.
We've got a lot of them for some reason, a theme here we pulled out at the end.
You know, I think the other big title for nonfiction graphic novels is Smile by Renée Telgemeier.
Yeah, I was going to say.
Which is not for adults, and so is not often continued in those lists, but is being read by so many people.
The most popular comic of the last 10 years, like, is just constantly at the top of like the bestseller list.
That's Dog Man.
Oh, you're right.
So would we read this again?
Yes.
Yeah.
I, for some reason, borrowed books from the library instead of reading the ones in my house this month for this topic. So my to-read list of things I own in my house went down by like one book.
I have one that Matthew left here that I should have read this month and didn't.
The Lady's Guide to Comfortable Footwear or something?
Sensible Footwear, A Girl's Guide about lesbian history.
That took me like multiple years to read, Jam, so don't worry about it. To get around to reading, not to actually read. But that's a big book.
It is, yeah.
That's not one you can sit down and read in one go.
Was not going to lug that around this month.
Yeah, there's a reason it stayed in Canada. It's too big.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Book Club for Masochists. Find us on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. If you like the show, subscribe so you never miss an episode, and consider giving us a positive rating and or review. If you've already done that, thank you.
For all our URLs and social media accounts, the 4 in our name is a numeral. You can go to our website at bookclub4m.com, join our Facebook group at facebook.com/groups/bookclub4m, and find us on Instagram at bookclub4m. We also have a Discord server, link in the show notes. Please join it, or don't if you don't want to. Our email address is bookclub4m@gmail.com.
On our website, you can find show notes that will provide links to the things that we mentioned, social media info for everyone who appeared on this episode, if you happen to still be on social media, which I am no longer, and our genre-based book lists of titles by authors of color.
You can suggest a genre or title for us to read, or request a reading recommendation from us. We have a form you can fill out at our website, bookclub4m.com. You probably could also go to Discord and ask us for a recommendation. And you might get ones from other listeners there as well. No promises on reading your specific suggestion, but if you ask for a recommendation, we will give you one.
All opinions are our own and do not reflect our places of employment, if they exist.
Book Club for Masochists is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial Share Alike 4.0 International License.
Our theme music is To Arrakis by Dark Sun from the Free Music Archive.
New episodes are the first and sometimes the third Tuesday of every month.
Join us again on Tuesday, April 16th. We'll be giving an update on media we've recently enjoyed that isn't for the podcast.
Then on Tuesday, May 7th, we'll be discussing books from indie publishers.
Gosh, another real not genre.
That's the theme for the year.
Apparently. Jam, I 100% just looked at the screen and was like, did Jam just put on a hat? And thought you had like a poofy hat with like one of those little puffs on the top.
My hair does look like a fascinator sometimes. I like have been, it's at a weird length right now where sometimes when I put it up, the bun is in like two big chunks and it looks like I'm wearing like a big bow on top of my head.
Awesome. Love it.
Is Matthew glitching?
Yeah, Matthew's glitching.
Please consider note that this episode is still an hour and 35 minutes long, and I did not talk about any books.